This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. Doctors, nurses, police, and firefighters are often thought of as heroes when caring for trauma victims in emergency situations. Think the Boston Marathon bombing or a firefighter pulling someone out of a burning building. The same goes for social workers who keep a close eye on families and children in crisis. But these same professional caregivers are often traumatized by some of the things they see and hear in their day-to-day work. And the question we address this hour is, how are they being cared for? Joining us are Vic Comfer, a social worker. He is also the director and co-producer with Rodney Wittenberg of Portraits of Professional Caregivers, Their Passion, Their Pain, which is a documentary. Welcome, Vic.
Thank you, Mary.
And Sandra Bloom is a board-certified psychiatrist and co-director of the Center for Nonviolence and Social Justice at Drexel University, and she is also featured in the film. Hello, Sandra.
Hello, Mary.
So, Vic, first to you, why did you decide to make this documentary?
Well, I worked in the area of child protective services for a little over 20 years, and after that as a medical social worker in hospice care, and then in clinical work with elder folks. And I saw, particularly in the first two positions, the child protective services and hospice work, the enormous emotional impact upon the workers themselves of the work itself. I even developed a workshop on that topic, when trauma or death occurs on the caseload, ways of really supporting staff. Because naturally, there's a great deal of emphasis on how can we help clients, and that's first and foremost. But the backstory, so to speak, is what is the impact upon the caregiver herself or himself? And many were suffering what I called at the time grief. This was back in the 90s. And since then, we recognize this phenomenon as secondary traumatic stress. But it's a lot like grief with sadness, perhaps, sometimes sleep disturbance, sometimes your appetite changes, you may have trouble concentrating. All these types of symptoms I was beginning to see, and I really felt that the public was unaware of it, that it's not talked about very much. Even in the professions, it's not discussed as openly as it needs to be. And so I felt that if I could convey the stories, because I think stories are what people really want to hear and witness. And so I began interviewing the child protective workers on camera. And out of that, through other connections, I began to realize, well, secondary trauma spreads the gamut of all of these helpers, whether we're talking about a trauma nurse or a clinical psychologist that is working with veterans coming back. So it's quite widespread.
Did you experience any of this yourself?
I did, yeah. I learned through experience, through the grief of certain cases. It's also a collective grief. It's like, you know, the first, second, or third you sort of cope with, but then by the time the eighth or tenth or whatever, and it's constantly, you know, going by you. So it did come out of my personal experience as well.
Sandra, there's been a lot written about the sometimes overwhelming needs of family caregivers, say the person caring for a loved one with Alzheimer's. What sort of distinction should we draw, if any, between the family caregiver and the professional caregiver?
Well, yeah, that's kind of hard to
maybe there is no distinction.
Yeah. Well, I think sometimes there probably isn't a distinction, but I think for a family caregiver, I think about it as relentless stress. You never get a break. You don't get a weekend off. You don't get a vacation, right? Whereas at least if you're a caregiver, hopefully you have some time off and you can do some self-care.
We've pulled some clips from the documentary, and in this clip, we're going to hear from Agnes P. Albany, a family therapist and psychiatric center director, about some of her experiences.
I can remember one patient, there were like four police officers, the patient was in chains, they called the guards, there were six guards, they put him in the padded room. And I can remember standing at the counter and thinking, this is, you know, I don't get involved in that. I don't have to call more guards, I don't have to do whatever. But then I stopped and my stomach was in such a knot, was shaking. It takes its toll physically. And you tell yourself in your head, I'm a therapist, I can deal with this, you know. but my body wasn't dealing with it. Finally, at the end, I was walking down the hall on my way to a meeting, and I just blacked out. And I'm on the floor, came around, heard voices. They took me into the trauma room. And the chaplain at the hospital said to me, "Your body has finally told you you have to stop, hasn't it?"
So she's a therapist, and she thought, "I can deal with it." And so often, I'm guessing that is not the case, Sandra.
Yeah, I think Vic referred to it. What's the amount of exposure? And that can vary over time in your own life. So you're more vulnerable when things are not going well in your own life as a caregiver, as a therapist, or any kind of caregiver. So, yeah, I think that it affects all of us in different ways, but powerfully.
Vic, you got into this a little bit for us, but if you could just give us a list. What are some of the symptoms, emotional first, and physical, of a secondary traumatic stress?
Well, there are a lot of symptoms. A person's feelings can be affected, feelings of grief, of loss, of sadness. There can be anger, anxiety, fear. Cognitively, mentally, maybe in the throes of this secondary trauma, there's difficulty concentrating, or you may be having flashbacks that are not too different than what a person with PTSD might be having. There's a certain, it's not as severe, but it's somewhat similar. You could have lapses in your memory or nightmares. I've never heard of anyone that has all of these, but there could be some spread of these. Physical symptoms, sleep disturbance, appetite changes, fatigue, nauseousness, rapid heartbeat. Behaviorally, sometimes people, professionals will withdraw either personally with maybe family or friends, or they may withdraw from their clients. They might stop liking some of their clients. All of these are sort
resenting
of...
resenting some of them?
Resenting some of them. All of these would be signs of someone who is a possibly and probably a very genuine caregiver, but overwhelmed and needs a lot of support themselves in the workplace in particular. What we have found is that these symptoms are not so unusual, that they're also normative. Sometimes professionals think, well, something's terribly wrong with me, and they don't even want to talk about it. But actually, the studies indicate that it's quite common in a number of these professions, and something that if we can talk about it, then we can begin to address it and find hope and resolution, and there is plenty of that there too.
When you are going through training in whatever profession it is, are you taught to expect this sort of secondary traumatic stress, Sandra?
No, I think in general quite the opposite, that you went into this work because you have some inclination or ability to do it, and you're expected to do it and toughen up. And so I think there's been very little work until probably quite recently about helping young physicians, young psychologists, young social workers, anybody in any of the caregiving professions, police officers and fire people. There's been very little preparation for what you can expect and what might happen to you emotionally.
Sandra, in the documentary, you say you were taught that you couldn't feel other people's emotions. Could you get into that? What does that mean exactly?
Well, I think we've all heard that. Well, you can't know what another person feels, right? Kind of common normative expectation. But around 10 years ago, there was a brain system discovered called the mirror neuron system. And as it turns out, when I see your face and you're expressing an emotion, the same part of my brain gets triggered, lights up. And so I feel the same emotion very quickly. It's part of our very deep mammalian programming. It's because we're a social species. So we need to take signals from each other that might alert us to danger or might be part of our emotional connectedness to each other. So we pick up those signals very, very quickly. And then depending on who you are and what your experience has been and what your family's been like, you may learn to cut that information off really quickly, but it's still there. Your body is still reacting to the emotion of the other person.
So that's a body reaction. That's not necessarily empathy.
It's part of, it's like the substrate, it's like the biology of empathy. That's really what it is. And it begins as soon as we're born. And we're going mirroring with our a maternal caregiver immediately from the time we're, you know, if infants can first see the face, which is soon as we're born. So, yeah, it's really a very, very basic programming. It's not psychological. We're talking biological substrate of empathy.
So what part then does empathy play and should empathy play in mm-hmm. these professions, Vic?
Well, empathy is absolutely necessary, and that's part of the irony of it all, because to be effective, one has to open one's heart and one has to connect with one's client or patient or whoever one's trying to help or protect. And the very process of doing that creates vulnerability in the sincere and skillful caregiver. So you can't do good work, as one of our commentators in the film says, without empathy. But on the other hand, it makes you vulnerable. And if you know that and you know the importance of addressing the impact of the emotion that may be aroused in yourself, then you get through it. And you can even have very profound and beautiful experiences with your patients and clients. But it's if you approach it naively and you're simply empathic, but you're not aware of how to do self-care or how to take care of your peers in a mutual kind of way, that seems to be what the resolution of these issues are.
One of your interviewees says empathy is necessary, but it can leave fingerprints on your heart.
Isn't that amazing?
That's a great quote.
Yes. Yeah.
There's also a sense as a professional caregiver that you can't do your job incorrectly because somebody else's life is at stake. And this just sounds like an enormous amount of pressure, Sandra.
It is. I think that what may be most wearing on caregivers is the sense of extraordinary responsibility in a situation of relatively little control. You really, if you're a surgeon in an operating room, you have control over many of the factors, but you still don't have control over the human's body, you know, but you have a lot of control of what you can do and not to do. The land of helping people with not necessarily bodily responses is it's fraught, because there's no clear guidelines necessarily for you need to have empathy, but you also need to have boundaries. You need to be a human being, but you're not. You have a very subscribed dimension of your relational impact with that person. So it's more like an art form than it is a concrete manualized process that you can follow.
We'll get to your response in just a moment, Vic, but we're going to go to a break in just a bit here. We're talking about a new documentary this hour, which raises the question of whether professionals on the front line of care, doctors, nurses, child protective workers, suffer emotional trauma related to their work, and if they do, which services are available to them. If this is something you've experienced in your line of work, or if you'd simply like to join the conversation with a question or comment, our number is 888-477-9499. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. More just ahead. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. Sandra Bloom joins us this hour. She is a board-certified psychiatrist and co-director of the Center for Nonviolence and Social Justice at Drexel University. Sandra is also featured in the film Portraits of Professional Caregivers, Their Passion, Their Pain. And Vic Comfer is a social worker and director and co-producer with Rodney Wittenberg of this film, which is a documentary. As always, lines are open at 888-477-9499. Our email address is radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can send us a tweet at @whyyradiotimes. And going into the break, Vic, we were talking about the fact that you absolutely, at least professional caregivers, feel that you can't do your job incorrectly, and it places an awful lot of pressure on that person as they're trying to do their job day in and day out.
So a couple of examples come to mind that you cannot make a mistake, and if you do, the consequences can be not only horrible for the patient, but also for yourself. I'm thinking, for example, of the story that Commissioner Charles Ramsey presents in the film. He was the police commissioner in Washington, D.C. in 2002 during the D.C. sniper incidences. And he talks about not only in this situation but in many others that police work is under an absolute microscope. Every minutia, every little thing that you do. You could say the same thing about Child Protective Services. The workers feel like everything they do is being so carefully and legally scrutinized to the point that that adds an additional high level of pressure to what's already stressful. That is, their contact with the patient or the client in itself is enough stress. But then on top of that, you have a litigious society and a situation where one is under the microscope, which if the outcomes, which may be completely beyond your control, are negative, you will suffer probably very severe consequences. So people live with that threat or that possibility.
So is it best to keep in mind then that at the end of the day, there is only so much you
Precisely.
Can do? But on the flip side, if a child is being supervised by child welfare workers and is hurt or even dies, there's only so much you can do doesn't work. And, of course, it doesn't play very well, especially in the media.
That's right. I think we've set up an unrealistic system to think that protection of children who are really vulnerable can be done by an agency. It's really an all of us problem. And when a child dies, we've all failed, not just the child welfare worker. They don't have that much control over what happens. Nobody wants to take children away from their parents because that causes problems. And yet, when they make a bad judgment, and they're usually really very complex judgment calls about what's going to do more harm. And so there's no good guidebook for it. Nobody's there to tell you what to do. That's the right thing to do.
And going into the profession, there's no training.
There is no way to really training, but training doesn't substitute for experience.
Not training on the job, but education in terms of what the job might entail in terms of emotional stress.
Yeah, no, I don't think that it doesn't exist.
Okay. As I mentioned earlier, we pulled some clips from the documentary, and I'd like to introduce Ann Coyle, a neonatal nurse, who tells the story of a baby she'd been caring for.
I remember we had a baby who was breathing a little bit fast. And I said to the father and the grandmother, you know, it's normal. Babies can have more lung fluid. They could have this, they could have that. But, you know, I think the baby will be fine. A few hours later, the baby started to get sicker and started to breathe worse. And within 3 or 4 hours, the baby died. And I'll never forget that.
Ann says the worst moment is when a parent or a caregiver comes in and you have to break the news. She also says, again, when she was going through school, training to be a nurse, she was taught to be professional and not to become attached. That is, some people can do that.
I think that's part of the
especially
mythology.
Especially working with infants, I think it would be extremely difficult. At the same time, though, Ann says it's okay to cry. Is Sandra Bloom, is it okay to show emotion as a professional caregiver?
No, I think it's really critical. It's a double-edged sword, right?
Yeah.
Emotions are powerful, so they can be powerfully good, powerfully problematic. So, yes, it makes you more human as a caregiver. When you are feeling something that the other person's feeling and you respond to it, there is a truth to that is about integrity in the relationship. On the other hand, you don't want to be so emotional that the other person, who's really the person that's the primary person, feels like they have to take care of you.
Yeah.
So that's what I mean by it being such an art form, that that will vary from person to person, situation to situation. So you have to be tuned in enough to be able to determine how much do I have to protect this other person from my own feelings, and how much is it okay and really actually really helpful if I share something that I'm experiencing as they are. Tricky.
Yeah.
Very tricky.
Yeah, Vic, you don't want to make it worse for the family.
Absolutely not. So there is that boundary. You can express and show your empathy and your feelings, but as Sandra so nicely said there, you don't want to be in a position where they feel like they're taking care of you. But I do think that what we're kind of up against right now is a stereotypic view of what it means to be a professional. And that has such slogans as you must always be truly objective. You must have a distance. You must not let things get to you or bother you particularly. But the human side of the professional can be touched by certain powerful cases. If you're a clinician, and we have one in the film, who is hearing with the Veterans Administration, by the way, and he's hearing war stories constantly. And then one of the people he feels a therapeutic attachment to unexpectedly completes suicide. That is a powerful impact upon the therapist who was not anticipating that, who has to deal with a whole range of feelings. So it would actually, I think, not be very normal if one did not have a real feeling of emotional loss and sorrow in a moment like that. But the mythology around professionalism, sometimes we carry it to an extreme and we forget that. We forget that human side.
In a moment like that, I'm assuming you don't want to take it home with you, if at all possible. And you're laughing. I'm chuckling. I'm assuming it's impossible not to take it home with you at times. But it can't be healthy. You've got to be able to sleep at night.
That's right. Exactly. And it's what makes the whole issue of talking about this issue and integrating it into training and workplace practices so important, because people in the documentary, that gentleman who was at the VA says – oh, no, it was a different person who said, burnout, yeah, that exists, but there's also rust out. And I think that was a beautiful way of kind of saying, yeah, that's what happens to – we lose many of our best – most caring people because they rust out. They just get exhausted in body, mind, and soul.
I love the analogy. Mm-hmm. It's an old car that's slowly rusting out from the inside. Well, how do you flag rust out and what do you do about it, Vic?
Well, that's an expression by John Weaver, who's a remarkable caregiver with the Red Cross, who was the coordinator of the families in Western Pennsylvania at 9/11. He coordinated and received those families. And what he's talking about that's different than burnout is that the person hasn't lost everything, but they've just worn down. They still have integrity. They still care about their clients. They're still trying to do a good job, but they don't have the vitality anymore, the inspiration. And of course, that reflects in the work. What you do about that, there are several things. One is a very intentional and conscious plan of self-care, of understanding where your vulnerabilities are, and also understanding and identifying what gives you joy and pleasure in your life, what helps you to thrive, and really examining, am I taking time for that kind of self-care? And that's different for each person because each has his or her own methods of restoration and support from friends, family, faith, whatever. But it's more important too, or beyond self-care, is what's happening in the workplace, and is the workplace creating the mechanisms and structures whereby peers can come together and support each other? That's how you don't have to take it home so much, if you can have the support systems right there in the office. And some of the more progressive organizations and ones that are adopting, for example, Sandra Bloom's sanctuary model are indeed building that in. And there are a number of different methodologies. In the film, for example, we show four different styles of kind of self-care among the peers. So there is a lot of hope there, and it also restores a sense of meaning and what's also called compassion satisfaction. The secondary trauma has the name also of compassion fatigue, but the flip side of that is what gives you joy and meaning, and why do you do this work, bottom line? So
sure, people get into this work for a reason. It's sometimes it's because it's fast-paced, especially if you're an EMT, if you're a police officer, a firefighter, you're really, your adrenaline's pumping. But, The flip side, of course, is the possibility of burnout. I'd like to get to a comment from Jan. Jan says, I'm a psychologist with experience in the fields that you're discussing. I think it's very important that training and self-care are emphasized from the get-go. Also, people can become traumatized as a result of being naive in terms of what they have to offer. So thinking about getting into these professions, Sandra, what should you be considering before you jump in?
Well, I think what some people get into the caring professions because they have a lot of work to do themselves and they want to find out things about themselves, which isn't necessarily a problem at all, but it can be. You have to know that about the level of responsibility and the toll it can take. And I think the best way to know about all that is to be able, as Vic said, to talk to people, particularly people who have more experience than you do. The problem of why we have to talk about this and systematically bring it back now is it used to exist. There used to be time that was just part of the schedule of understanding that you needed to talk to each other. You needed to debrief. You needed to have supervision. With the fast-paced nature of our professional environments and the enormous pressure for greater and greater and greater productivity, in my little quote marks, then what's gone is just that interactive space of just sitting around and being able to go over your day.
And also, people tend to be looking down at their devices more as opposed to talking to each other.
Precisely. We have a really wonderful scene in the film where the firefighters are debriefing and talking together, and they acknowledge precisely what Sandra was saying, and that is that the firefighters used to have a culture in which they sat around the firehouse, they had their meals together, and they talked informally about all sorts of stuff, including what happened on the last fire and how you were affected and so forth. But now they are telling us they look at their devices and they're texting and they're, you know, doing the internet and all that. And so the fire department, we were able to film some of the very early stages here in Philadelphia of a stress first aid program that they are starting. And it's a peer-based approach where peers look out for each other and they look for those signs and symptoms that we were talking about a moment ago. And without pressure, approach their colleague, how are you doing? How were you affected by this? And if the signals really are quite dramatic, perhaps, then they might try to take it a step further, again, voluntarily. Well, let's talk about this. Let's debrief about this.
But when you talk about strong signals, what are you talking about?
Well, in the film, there's a scene in which one of the firefighters says, one of my colleagues came in. He's normally a happy-go-lucky, friendly, jolly, jovial kind of guy. But this day, he was not like that. He was not in character. He was different. And the firefighter is sort of kicking himself and saying, why didn't I pick up on this? I didn't realize how serious this was. And that individual completed suicide that night. And so he has this horrible feeling that he's dealing with the grief, but also if I had only been aware of the signs and symptoms. So part of what we hope the film will do is both make the public aware and develop more insight and understanding and support for the public servants and people that we all call on, but also that the professionals themselves will become much more cognizant, much more conscious. It will do the kind of outreach that we're talking about. But that won't happen under the pressure of many of our systems right now unless there is the leadership and the intentionality to do it.
It can be hard to approach somebody who you suspect might be in trouble. We don't want to intrude. Mm-hmm. Sandra, how do you take that first step if you think somebody's in trouble?
I think you just make the time to talk to them, sit down over a cup of tea and
what say,
hey, what, you know, I noticed that that you seem to be feeling pretty down. What's going on? What's happened? The whole trauma issue, this whole big issue of trauma-informed services, this is a part of it, is really about shifting the primary question that we address people with, which kind of is an implication, what's wrong with you? Like, you're not your normal self, so something must be wrong with you, to what happened to you? And it's really understanding that people are being affected by things in their environment and each other all the time, sometimes for not very good things. And they're not going to talk about it if they feel like they're going to be put down or blamed or made to feel stupid or ashamed of whatever it is they're feeling. So if you're just open to it and just, you don't have to do anything except listen. That's it. I think people think they have to do something to fix whatever is going on. And actually, you can't fix it. You can only be there to listen and share.
Well, if I'm taking away from the film what I think I'm taking away, there's a fairly significant risk of suicide among certain professions, police, firefighting, you're nodding your head. I mean, do you mention the word suicide? Do you express that concern if you feel somebody is on the edge? And
say,
what
I'm,
do you say? I'm there for you?
Yeah,
or
I'm worried.
Call me?
I'm worried about you. I've just seen you be really different. I noticed that you're drinking more. I feel scared for you. I need to know what do you need to do to be okay, and how can I help? All you have to think about is if you were in that position, what would you need from somebody else?
Because especially
not to be told what to do.
In some professions, it's almost a moray. I mean, you don't show that you are, you know, in that sort of distress. You can't seem that way.
Precisely. And so many professional caregivers will not acknowledge it because they feel that there's a stigma. They feel like they won't be trusted as much. This is not simply the case with police and perhaps firefighters, but it cuts across every one of these professions. It again gets back to this mystique, this stereotype of what a good professional is, but we want to broaden that and know that a good professional acknowledges their human side and acknowledges how they are affected by these things and knows that it's normal.
All right. We'll be back in just a moment on Radio Times. We're talking to Vic Comfer, a filmmaker and a social worker who's co-produced a documentary called Portraits of Professional Caregivers, Their Passion, Their Pain. And Sandra Bloom is a board-certified psychiatrist and is also featured in the film. Our number is 888-477-9499. We'll be taking your calls in just a moment. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. And our guests this hour include Vic Comfer. He is a social worker and director and co-producer with Rodney Wittenberg of Portraits of Professional Caregivers, Their Passion, Their Pain. And Sandra Bloom joins us as well. She's a board-certified psychiatrist and co-director of the Center for Nonviolence and Social Justice at Drexel University. And calls are coming in to 888-477-9499. If you'd like to send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or a tweet at @WHYYRadioTimes. So let's get to some of the callers. Julie in Jenkintown, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you so much. This is such a fantastic show.
Thank you.
I spend all my time thinking about, actually. I am an oncology and massage therapist and educator, and we spend a lot of time both in my working, but also in educating, dealing with what is burnout and how to actually, like the guests were saying, really have a solid self-care piece in your life, and also to spend time really delving into your own suffering and mortality in order to really just be with the person that you're facing, not trying to fix, but really just being there as another human being, as well as doing your job. I mean, it's a dance, and you have to be pretty creative. But
yeah.
I think burnout really comes from avoiding your feelings as opposed to just thinking into them and in the appropriate fashion dealing with it.
Thank you, Julie.
I work at a cancer.
Oh, go ahead.
Really briefly, I work at a cancer treatment center that brings to it I think it's an international program called the Schwartz Rounds, and it's a program where just everyone who works in the hospital can come for their lunch hour once a month and discuss an issue that is non-clinical. And you have doctors and us massage therapists and people who work in the cafeteria, and we all just discuss the same subject from an emotional place. And it creates this wonderful sense of community and I think really decreases burnout as well.
Thanks, Julie, for the call to Radio Times. And Vic, you are nodding your head.
Well, I really appreciate that call. It's very interesting. And the Schwartz Center model is, as the listener just reported, indeed, the call-in reported, said to be quite remarkable in creating that environment of support in the workplace. The little distinction I'd want to make here, maybe it's not too little, that is between burnout and secondary trauma. Burnout is also very real. It's not unusual. It usually comes from the unrealistic expectations, often of people entering a profession that in an idealistic way, they're going to change the world quickly. And when that doesn't happen, they become disillusioned. And sometimes the general atmosphere of an organization can just feel so negative. And over time, the person starts to burn out and become disillusioned. Secondary trauma, on the other hand, is more directly related to the impact of working with a particular tragic situation or person. It's that personal contact, that grief that the professional experiences. And it's also the accumulative effect of maybe having many similar cases. So burnout's very real. It's good to – I'm glad that was brought up in the question there and statement, but also to make a little distinction there. Secondary trauma is a little different.
Hospice workers have one of the tougher jobs. You're working with people who are in the last stages of life. And in the documentary, you interview Joan Ordeal, a hospice social worker who talks about the emotions she brings home. And we have a clip of Joan, so let's take a listen.
Part of what comes up for me is that piece of me, that the mother, the wife, the family person. I can get angry. She's dying. She shouldn't be dying. She's 44 years old. She shouldn't be dying. She shouldn't be having to say goodbye to her family.
And yet she really can't share that with the family. Or can she, Sandra?
Yeah, I think under those conditions she probably can.
Yeah.
And it would be quite meaningful to them. And they would know she really cared and she was really engaged. And I think, you know, when people watch this and listen to what we're saying, I think that we're not talking about rocket science here. We're talking about really simple, basic human contact, caring from the heart kinds of behaviors and attitudes that are achievable for anybody. But in the world we live in, that those behaviors and attitudes have been discouraged. And so what people often get trapped in is guilt and self-blame and trying to defend against the blame of other people. And that is toxic.
And yet I believe this was Joan in the film. She said the amount of love that can be pulled up in hospice work is breathtaking.
Yes, exactly. And that's what we refer to as compassion satisfaction, that while there can be this very sad and grief-laden side, it's absolutely awesome. And to see the affection and love that family members may be exhibiting, not only to their loved one, but to each other and to the hospice team. So that brings inspiration. Plus, it's a profoundly intimate experience to be with someone who is dying, and just as a birth being present. And the honor of being trusted enough to be present in those moments is quite inspiring to many hospice people.
It can be a roller coaster, obviously. Sandra, when is it time to take a second look and decide whether you need to step back or away from this profession or this sort of profession?
I've wondered, Mary, whether there shouldn't be a time span, that is recommended. I think that if you become really cynical, hopeless, because I think what we haven't emphasized is that the whole issue of secondary traumatic stress, vicarious trauma, compassion fatigue is also about potential changes in worldview that could be you become more positive and honoring the love that's there, also potentially much more negative about the way the world is and your interface with it. So I think if you've become really cynical, if you're finding that you're short-tempered, if you know that you're drinking too much or just not taking care of yourself, eating too much, you know, not exercising, doing the things that should be good for your own health, it's a signal to say, I need to step back, even if it's a little bit, begins a little bit, but it may be, ultimately, it may mean life changes. I think it has for both of us. You know, we both are doing something different than we did 20 or 30 years ago. And that's part of, I think, the life stages that you go through. But I think it's also part of reckoning with what all this means to you personally. I think everybody has to do that.
All right, we've got a lot of calls to get to, so let's try to get to some of them. Carol in Levittown, Pennsylvania. Hello, and welcome to Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for talking about this. It's really important. I've been a veterinary technician for the last 23 years, and what I almost never hear about when a public conversation happens about compassion fatigue is that in veterinary medicine, that there's a high level of stress. You're dealing with dying animals, dogs and cats, or wherever you're working every day. Trauma every day. And not only the trauma of the animal or the abuse of the animal, but the related owners of the said animal.
Sure.
It's a very high stressful environment.
And do you find that that anybody talks about this in your environment, Carol?
We are just beginning to talk about it now. It's something I'm interested in, and I know that there's a lot of people who are affected by it.
Sandra?
There's a relatively high incidence of suicide in the veterinary profession. There are studies that show that veterinary professionals experience all those signs of secondary trauma, loss of hope and change in sleeping habits and eating and all of that.
You know what? I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I'm going to toss this over to Sandra. We're not sure about figures at this point, but suffice it to say, if you've ever been a pet owner, if you've ever had to have an animal euthanized, it's really rough.
It is. It's the first I've actually even thought about it in reference to this very obvious dilemma that the caller is bringing up because, I have a dog. I'm a dog person. And I can't handle any kind of movies or anything where animals get hurt. I can't watch it. So how they manage that, I have deep respect for how they do that. And having been as an owner with veterinary people who really compassionately deal with the loss of your pet, it's amazing that they can do that day in and day out. And it was very important to me on the other side of the table.
Carol, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's go to Marlena. She is in Reading, Pennsylvania. Hello, Marlena.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm an emergency and trauma nurse based at the Reading Hospital in Pennsylvania. And I wanted to talk about a program that one of our nurses has helped develop in conjunction with our chaplain department called Crisis Incident Stress Management, or CISM. It's a peer support program following a traumatic patient incident where the whole team comes together, debriefs emotionally, and if anyone needs further assistance dealing with that trauma, there is peer-to-peer counseling and referrals to professional help if needed. This is part of a multifaceted program that our nursing staff has been working on to combat compassion fatigue and vicarious trauma in our staff, and it's been adopted hospital-wide after being started in the emergency department.
And so, Marlena, I take it that you've participated. What have you experienced?
Well, I personally haven't been involved with a CISM debriefing myself.
Okay.
But we have gotten a lot of feedback from staff members who have participated and have found it very helpful in processing those difficult emotions and also building a feeling of community amongst the healthcare team where it's okay to talk about this and it's okay to have these kinds of emotions that stoic face you put on for the public. You don't have to keep that up with each other.
All right. We appreciate the call to Radio Times. Vic, what do you think? Sounds like a...
Well, I think that's another model that and those can be adapted to each organizational culture. It's really important, in fact, to develop a kind of I call them grief support committee or something of that type within an organization, and figure out what is the model that is most compatible with your culture. In the hospices, many of them in their team rounds on a weekly basis take a part of the meeting to light a candle, to lower the lights, to have quiet, to recognize by name and some of the beautiful human qualities of the person who has died. Maybe there are eight people that have died that week at the hospice, and they take time to honor the memory and also to honor the work of the team and their own collaboration and so forth, as well as thinking about what else does the family need. So those kind of built-in mechanisms are very, very important. And when they're missing, the professionals will suffer quite a bit. I think also the sanctuary model that that you've given such a beautiful structure to is geared in that direction.
Oh, yes, totally. I think the notion of what she was describing, that they've integrated it into the hospital setting, it should just be standard practice. It should just be basic operating processes that has occurred, because you need that to improve the workplace and the workers, the outcome of the workers. And yeah, and sanctuary is an organizational approach that we use.
Sandra, where does humor help to leaven a terrible tough situation?
You watched this right to the end, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
I think it's one of the key ingredients, and I think that you find that almost universally among caregivers, is that there is often a deep sense of humor, sometimes quite irreverent.
Okay?
Yeah, it's totally okay. because you're in a combat zones in many ways, and that's what it feels like. And so you're with other colleagues who can make a joke out of something that is so horrible and relentless that the physiological release really is having a good laugh. Not at somebody's expense, but having a laugh about often the utter absurdity of life.
Yeah. In this day and age, Vic, is it still easier in general, do you think, for women to talk it out as opposed to men?
Well, to the extent that many women have more experience in relational development and a greater readiness sometimes than guys have to talking things out, to expressing their feelings, then I think they have some advantage. Now, there are plenty of guys that can do that, and many of them in these professions as well. But
a little bit more buttoned up.
Yeah, I think so.
Is that an issue, Sandra? Or am I way behind the times here?
No, I don't think you're behind the times. And it has a lot to do with cultural norms, about what's expected of people.
Okay, well, unfortunately, we're out of time, but that's such a pleasure. Sandra Bloom, good to have you here, board-certified psychiatrist and co-director of the Center for Nonviolence and Social Justice. And Vic Comfer, social worker and director and co-producer with Rodney Wittenberg of Portraits of Professional Caregivers, Their Passion, Their Pain. And you just hand me something there, Vic. Why don't you take it?
So we hope people will visit our website, caregiversfilm.com, and we'll be able to arrange screenings.
Okay. Our engineer today has been Kevin Griffin. Our producers, Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. And our intern is Diana Allen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain on Radio Times. Thanks so much for joining us.